Hello, you're listening to Insight Says, a podcast about mental health and counseling. I'm your host, Kira Dineen, and today I'm going to get to know the clinical psychologist at Insight Counseling in Ridgefield, Connecticut, Dr. Mary Murphy. She's a licensed clinical psychologist who specializes in counseling, executive functioning, academic coaching, and biofeedback. She's the director of psychology and testing services at Insight Counseling. Dr. Murphy completed her PhD doctoral training at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and fellowship training at Yale University School of Medicine. She holds a Connecticut state license in substance abuse counseling. She also has extensive training and expertise in psychological testing needed to diagnose children and adults. A large part of her current practice focuses on providing comprehensive psychological evaluations needed for student 504s and IEPs. Dr. Murphy's counseling practice focuses on helping adolescents and adults with ADHD, concussions, depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. So thanks so much, Dr. Murphy, for coming on the show and sharing about your career and your clinical practice.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I want to start out with asking you why you pursued the field of psychology. What was the drive behind it?
So going back to the beginning, let me think. In the beginning, I went back to school, actually. So I was already working in substance abuse as a substance abuse counselor. And I was working in hospitals and, you know, detox and rehab settings, and realized that I wouldn't be able to be the director someday and kind of develop programs and help people in a more broad way, especially in the context of research that I was really interested in. I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't go back and get a PhD. So I enrolled in a program to get my PhD, and just the kind of classes that I ended up starting with was starting with substance abuse, and I ended up getting a specialization in health psychology. So people who have chronic health diseases, I was working, I had the intention of always working with people in medical settings that were dealing with like kind of chronic management of things like substance abuse, which is a chronic self-care, chronic relapsing condition, just like diabetes or high blood pressure. And so that was my main interest. And I knew I wanted to develop programs and research studies that would be able to look into, you know, more far-reaching ways and not just one-to-one on a therapy basis.
In order to get to that large-scale impact,
yes.
You were like, you know what, the PhD makes sense because you're able to take your career a little bit further and have a bigger impact.
Yes, yes. It would be broader, yes.
And how did you go about that? How did you become a clinical psychologist?
So I went to a program that offered health psychology because of that interest. And at the time, there were only 5 in the country. And I was very lucky that one was right in New York. And so I went to Yeshiva University, which was on the medical campus of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And so it was an amazing blend of being able to be having contact with medical professionals, the healthcare settings, and learning about the psychological aspects of what people go through when they have different disorders and health crises to manage. And so it was a really very interesting kind of foundation, because the first year of school, we actually were in school with the medical students, and then we separated off into, you know, they went on to medicine and we went into more advanced studies in psychology. But we all had the same base and very similar mentors. And so I was able to take courses and do research under, you know, some of my, you know, mentors that were able to help me get started in learning how to create a research career. And my research was based on how to develop clinical methods, like counseling methods, for working with people. So that's why it was always a blend of counseling and research.
And what types of classes were you able to take in this program? You said some were with the med students, which is great to have that rapport with them and really be able to understand how you can communicate with them. Because in your career, you definitely communicate with a lot of medical directors and things of that nature. But class-wise, what did you get into?
So a lot of the foundation of a PhD program is, you know, taking the foundational, you know, core curriculum that starts with clinical counseling methods. So I started to develop my kind of specialty very early on because of mentors that were in my program, and they taught me about motivational counseling. And that became the style that I actually adopted and stick with even through today. And so a lot of the coursework was, you know, learning to be able to do research. So a lot of it was statistics and how to develop programs. And so on top of counseling methods, there was a nice blend of both focus on clinical and research.
And through this experience, were you able to also specialize in, you know, that certain area, but also thinking about what age groups you were going to want to work with once you graduated?
Yeah. And my experience was that we were put very quickly into working in the field. And so I had most of my experience with younger clients before graduate school. But in graduate school, most of our what were called practicums, where we got to work in the community for the first time, were mostly with adult population. And most of mine were all substance abuse focused, and HIV, people with HIV disease. And there was a lot of research coming out of Einstein at the time. They were really like the mecca of the being on the forefront of HIV research, which was a game changer for people that had substance use disorders. So I got
there was a lot of breaking things at that time.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Because I started working in the field when there was just one single medicine for HIV. And then I started in this really groundbreaking research with people who were able to give, you know, a new standard of care for the very first time and establishing that it was effective. And so I was really, you know, grateful for the experience to be on the forefront of that. And it was during the time that people with substance use disorders weren't being offered treatment for HIV, because a lot of people were so afraid that their compliance or adherence would be poor, and so they weren't being offered treatment. And so a lot of the programs that I was learning how to develop was doing something called directly observed therapy, trying to increase treatment adherence for substance use so that people would be allowed to have access to their HIV management medications. So it was really a fascinating time, and I got to see everything turn around so much, from people who were all dying in the beginning to it becoming a complete, just chronic, lifelong disorder for people.
It's different today, having people that you know that they are HIV positive and they're continuing to live and thrive.
Yeah.
And it's just so different than just, you know, a decade mm-hmm. or two ago.
Exactly.
You mentioned a little bit earlier of motivational therapy. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what that is, what that treatment style is, and your approach using it?
Yes. So motivational counseling is based on motivational interviewing, which is a style that people in substance use a lot, but with any kind of problem that a client might have that they're ambivalent about, whether they feel like they're able to work on it, or that, you know, they're potentially even depressed and feel like they can't make a difference, and so their motivation is a little low. It helps people increase their confidence to be able to move forward and break past that ambivalence. So when people feel stuck and they are not able to make progress, sometimes motivational counseling really helps people move from, you know, being stuck to being able to take action steps. And it's a very non-confrontational method that is a really great thing. I learned about using it because I was working with mandated populations. By definition, nobody wanted to be there.
So it's mandated.
Yeah, exactly. So literally nobody wanted to be there. They were mandated by DCF or probation, and nobody showed up at the door signing up because they wanted to. So under those circumstances, it's really fascinating that people were able to do well. And I really attribute it to the fact that we were using these motivational strategies and helping the family members work with the family with the person who's having the substance use problem also use those methods. And So I was, you know, a believer from day one, and I've been able to continue using it. I've researched it. I've used it in my daily clinical practice all the time, and I continue to use it every day. I think it's great.
And with this approach, is it really being able to motivate the person to want to do things themselves and create that fuel within them to want to achieve certain personal, you know, goals or things of that nature?
Yeah, exactly. So for example, the first time I used motivational counseling was in my dissertation, and it was trying to understand people's reasons for seeking treatment. So what we found was that mandated clients, for example, they will have these external reasons or motivators to go to treatment. But motivational counseling helps to segue somebody into internal reasons for being in that treatment and
achieve
sticking.
Something for yourself and not for an external reward.
Exactly. Not for the fact that probation is telling you have to, or because parents tell you have to go to counseling. It becomes your own internal reasons. And so being able to elicit that kind of change talk in your client is what motivational counseling does. It helps to kind of meet the client where they're at, whatever stage that is, and using whatever motivation they have to be there, to not tell them that they're doing anything wrong. Like, for example, not saying like abstinence is the 100% goal, or saying that they, you know, have to work on this goal. It could be a subset of that goal, you know? So
not an all or nothing approach, but rather more realistic goals, and just like a diet or something where, you know, if you say, oh, I'm not going to eat any bread, it's like, well, maybe just bring it down a little bit because we all love bread, kind of thing. So,
exactly. Yeah. Yes. That's what it's like to meet a client where they're at.
And you do a lot, you know, as being a psychologist, and one of those aspects is psychological testing. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to the different types that are included in your treatment? And I know biofeedback is a big one that you can explain.
Sure. So testing in our practice, I'm the director of testing services, and so there's a couple of different classic cases of what we use testing for. One is a lot of people will come in and have an existing diagnosis where they say, the psychiatrist told me, for example, I have ADHD, and it's not a given. It's not a given that the person definitely has it. Most likely, people have not had actual objective testing. And so what we'll do is we'll use some, you know, face-to-face, you know, interview methods, but also some objective measures, which helps to kind of measure and quantify what those symptoms are, because people can be inattentive for tons of different reasons. And we always explain that to people, that, you know, if your brain is full, so you're anxious and you got a lot of things in your head, you can't hold on to everything. That could make you inattentive. Or you're depressed and your thinking is slowed down and you can't really grasp everything that people are saying. That could look like inattention. So there's so many different ways that someone could look inattentive, and it does not always at all equal ADHD. So with our objective measures and comprehensive evaluations, we're able to really see, yes, the person does have this diagnosis, and maybe they even have something else going on that's contributing to it. So for that one category of testing, it's really just clarifying diagnosis. And the second kind is for school. So a lot of people need testing to explain to schools, kind of translate to schools, how they can best kind of carry out their school career with accommodations so that they can do their best. And so a lot of the testing we end up needing to do is clarifying whether somebody has a learning disability. We call learning disorders now. Whether somebody has an attention issue that's affecting their ability to do well in school. Some people have processing difficulty, like auditory processing. You know, they're not, most of schools are all lecture-based, you know, like, and that's not how 90% of people learn. So
most of us are visual learners.
Yes, exactly. And so, like, the school system does not match that at all. And so it's interesting that, you know, we know that. We all know that, but it's...
But yeah, the teacher stands in front and we'll talk for an hour, and then you're supposed to take a test and learn all this information.
Exactly. It's a little strange that we still do this. We do know better, but we still do this. And so when we do testing, we're able to say, okay, this person is better as a visual learner, and these are the kinds of accommodations that if they had textbooks that were in this graphic form... if they had, you know, different placement in the room, it can't unfortunately come from parents. It can't come from a parent or the student themselves saying, I am not getting this and I don't know what else I can do, but I don't.
You need to have a professional actually go through this testing and say, these are the results and this is what, we suggest as, you know, their certain plan in terms of learning.
Right. Exactly. So schools and then even colleges, they won't accept documentation unless it's very specific, so that they can give either a 504 or an IEP in school. And so we spend a lot of time with doing testing like that.
So widening the scope a little bit, while you're doing this work, you're working closely with other mental health care specialists. Mm-hmm. Who are a couple of these people? What are their roles, especially here at Insight?
This is the most team-based practice I have ever heard of or worked
for. Most practices are you come in, you see your own patients, and mm-hmm. you leave. You don't have too much interaction other than asking each other about their families and kids.
Exactly. Yes. This is a very, very unique practice. So our interaction is that we're getting multiple viewpoints of the same person all day long, because it's a fascinating thing that I will see somebody for individual counseling, and then they're in a group therapy with two other clinicians that are co-leading a group, and then there's the director who always has contact with every client who's here in some form or another as a given, and then we also have a medication prescriber who's seeing another perspective, and also the fact that parents and family are always pulled into the picture. It's also unique. Not a lot of practices will have that comprehensive look, and it's like a 360 view of a client. So that work yields so much more, you know, information that we can use to be able to make better treatment plans, to stay on top of things. I find that people have such assertive plans put in place, and it's much more comprehensive. You know, it's really been great, the interaction we have with each other.
You can really give quality care, because if you maybe don't understand a certain facet of mm-hmm. A patient's history or what's going on present day, you can ask one of your fellow people here to mm-hmm. say, hey, what's your perspective on this? Or I know you specialize in adolescents specifically, and so start getting into those issues.
Exactly. We do that a lot. We have a great overlap of abilities in terms of the clinicians here, but also a lot of very interesting specialties. And so some people who have worked for years in the school systems can give us perspective on how this is playing out for the client in the school system. And we have the medication prescriber that's able to say, you know, this is something that they haven't tried before, that this might be a different approach we could add. And I have the ability to do the testing that gives some actual objective data that will be able to measure progress. And that's a very unique perspective too, that we do testing with people when they're referred to me, and they don't just get a report that goes to the therapist here, they get measures that, for example, questionnaires. So say I identify that somebody is diagnosed with depression and anxiety. And those are just some classic examples, but there's lots of other stuff like ADD and even OCD. And so whatever that identified thing is, I will give measures, questionnaires to the therapist and say, okay, monthly, let's do a check-in to monitor and see the progress of those symptoms. So we know this is the main underlying cause of what's going on. Let's be able to see and measure over time to show that there's progress and be able to intervene quickly if we see that there's not enough progress. So I find that that's another part of the comprehensive care that we do that I haven't seen at other practices.
Yes, definitely very collaborative of what I've experienced being in the office and seeing, you know, everybody really discussing things and hearing each other's opinions. Now, what aspects of being a psychologist do you enjoy? And the flip side of, are there things that that not so great, that it's kind of you wish you could either take out of the job or have less of? Maybe paperwork is kind of a common answer.
True. I think that it's really rewarding just to see that people feel that they understand their strengths and their weaknesses here, because I know that's pretty much a perspective we all share, but I know that not all therapists will do that, like, because our whole system is really based on symptoms, right?
Yeah.
So I like that as a psychologist, I can, especially because I also focus on testing and I isolate what people's strengths and weaknesses are, I love being able to share with people strengths that they may not have even realized they had, and how to approach it with not just saying, let's try to get rid of these symptoms, but let's try to just increase and work with your strengths. So
having that positive outlook versus highlighting the negative aspects.
Yeah. It's because I find a lot of people have never had somebody point that out to them. And
it can be eye-opening experience for someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And when people have symptoms, you know, it's a more depressed lens that people are looking at the world. And so I like being able to highlight to people the things that, you know, where we should just build on that foundation and use their resilience to help them move forward. The not so great?
Yeah, the not so great parts.
What's the not so great?
That's where we start getting kind of honest, right?
I know. Well, you know, it's funny because this practice is not so burdened, you know, different agencies I've worked at in the past were, you know, state-run agencies and hospitals and tons of paperwork. You're just buried.
And a lot of different pressures that go with being at a large institution or organization.
Absolutely. And here I feel like most of it is just the work, you know, the content of working with somebody is what we get to focus on.
So you get to focus on the parts that you like a little bit more.
Yeah.
Being somewhere like Insight.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that the hard parts are really just watching people's process, because especially because our practice focuses a lot on, you know, people with struggling with substance use, for example. You see chronic relapse. You see sometimes that people have a hard time. But I have to say, like, you know, people are showing such resiliency that I don't feel so burdened watching the recovery process even.
It can be inspirational, too, to go from hitting somewhere like rock bottom to be able to build yourself back up.
Yeah. I get much more of that, luckily.
Yes. And throughout your career, you kind of mentioned earlier of having some mentors that have really made a big difference in terms of kind of where you ended up in your career and where you're building towards. Anyone that was really key in that process? Any names to drop?
I would say that along the way, a lot of what I ended up doing was focusing on the motivational counseling. And so I've had a couple of brushes with greatness, you know, like that I could say. The people who created motivational counseling is Miller and Rolnick. And I got to meet Miller at his own institution.
Wow, University that must have been a bit of a starstruck moment for you.
Yeah, it was really very cool. And I was developing a research program at the time. And so during break at our conference, I even like asked him for input on my program. And he was just so down to earth. It's always so amazing to hear like people who are, you know, like I'm such a nerd. I see people in the research literature that I just read a journal article. And if you meet them in real life, it's like a, you know, a celebrity in your eyes, you know? And so I felt like that when I met him. And it's funny that they're just down to earth, regular people.
You think they're going to be big celebrity kind of and acting like that. But
yeah. And it was cool. He was just like, just gave input like any other colleague. It was really kind of cool. So a lot of the people that you get to meet That's something that I would recommend. Like, if anybody was going into the field of psychology, I would definitely recommend always going to, like, the American Psychological Association conference. It's every year. It's usually in Washington, D.C. when it's local. It's a great place to just, you know, you meet those leaders in the field and the thought leaders. And it's really, like you said, it's inspirational.
It can really reignite your motivations, too, of like, this is why I'm doing everything. You step out of your office.
Yes, exactly.
Any other advice that you can offer for students thinking about being a psychologist or already working towards this?
Yeah, so I'm a college professor, too. So a lot of what I do is I work with students who are thinking about going into this field and people who are working in the field for the first time and their practicums and stuff. And I always tell them that, you know, the dividing line is if you want to do therapy, there's not much of a need at all to get a PhD. If you have an interest in research, it's a given that you need it, you know. So I could have had my practice and stopped at the master's and had an LADC. I would have had my own private practice and stuck with that if I didn't have that additional interest. So,
wanting to go for the research and college professor,
yes.
That sort of thing, you were like, you know what? I need the PhD to achieve this.
Exactly. Yeah. So it always matters what the end goal is. And so that's how I steer, students who are always, you know, it's like alphabet soup out there. They're like, should I do an MSW or an LPC or an LADC or
there's
PhD?
A lot of options.
Yeah, there's so many different ways to get into this field. And the bottom line is everybody has in common that they want to help people. And it's just finding their niche in what's going to make most sense for them. And so that's how I say to backtrack. Think about the end goal. And backtrack, and then that guides you to what degree you would get.
And any particular resources to take advantage of for students, but also for parents or potential patients?
Yeah, so for students, I always say the American Psychological Association is APA.org, and it's a great resource from, you know, student to all the way through the rest of your career if you're in psychology.
Kind of the hub for information.
Yes, definitely. It's like a big database. And so that's an excellent resource. And there's a whole student section. So you just like use that tab. When it comes to parents wanting to understand more about mental health, I always say the National Institute of Health, and that's NIH.gov. And those, that's actually a resource that, has, you know, the internet can be like the wild, wild west, right? They call www the wild, wild west because you don't know what's a vetted resource, what's a good source of information. And so I always tell people, that NIH is great when it comes to, mental health and substance abuse. It's well vetted. Solid resource. And within there's information about, you know, if you're worried about your child's mental health, anxiety, depression, screen, it'll give you appropriate screening questions for when you're worried about what you're seeing with your kids. There's separate sites for teens to speak to teens. And there's really, it's just like a like bigger than a hub. I don't know what's bigger than a hub.
I don't know. We'll have to come up with our own word for that.
It's like the mecca of
there you go.
Information and the most solid resource out there.
Yeah. And that kind of goes for anything in healthcare, too, if we want to widen the scope a little bit.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on and really sharing your career and things that you've learned along the way. And what patients and clients should keep in mind. For more information about Dr. Murphy and Insight Counseling, you guys can head over to insightcounselingllc.com. Again, that's insightcounselingllc.com. And all of the resources we've mentioned, websites, they're all going to be on our website, insightcounselingllc.com, so you can access them there along with this podcast episode. You can also request an appointment to Insight at info@insightcounselingllc.com. Thanks for listening, guys, and join me next time to learn and discover more about mental health.